Post-Hypnotic Press presents an unabridged recording of According to Jennings by Anthony Buckeridge, narrated by Simon Vance. To David Davis. The Jennings books of Anthony Buckeridge span the years 1950 to 2000. Many social changes occurred during this time, including the adoption of decimal currency in 1971 to replace that of pounds, shillings, and pence. This edition contains all the original writings of Anthony Buckeridge and has not been altered or changed in any way. Chapter 1. The March of Progress. It was during the first few weeks of the summer term that the study of interplanetary flight was taken up with enthusiasm by the 79 boarders of Lynbury Court Preparatory School. According to Jennings, the age of space travel was only just around the corner, so in order to help the scientists of the world to skid round this troublesome bend, he and his friend Derbyshire lost no time in organising the Form 3 Space Pilots League, a willing band of pioneers eager to speed up the march of progress. There was never any doubt about the success of the movement. In no time at all, the space travel craze spread through the school, sweeping away such minor pursuits as the collection of cheese labels and matchbox tops, and covering the margins of Latin textbooks with unlikely-looking drawings of bigger and better rockets. Scientific societies with high-sounding titles sprang up overnight like mushrooms. Venables and Atkinson organized the Dormitory 6 Flying Saucer Spaceship and Atomic Rocket Development Corporation. And soon afterwards, Binns and Blotwell, the youngest boys in the school, became founder members of a mysterious group known as the Form 1 and Early Bedders Guided Missiles Club, which held secret meetings behind the boot lockers on wet half-holidays. During out-of-school hours, games of space warfare could be seen and heard at every point of the compass. Moon dwellers in white gym shoes pursued gangs of flannel-suited Martians across the cricket field, while serious-minded Earthmen scuttled up and down the corridors, uttering explosive voom-voom noises, or grunting ur-hurm, ur-hurm, from deep in their throats as they warmed up the motors of their imaginary rockets. And yet, despite this widespread enthusiasm, the masters of Lynbury Court could find no good word to say for the wave of atomic activity which burst upon their ears at unexpected moments. The headmaster, Mr. Pemberton Oakes, curtly refused to allow science fiction magazines to appear on the library shelves. Mr. Carter, the senior assistant, groaned inwardly and tut-tutted in despair each time a 10-year-old space mariner spluttered into sight. And Mr. Wilkins, who was long-suffering and short-tempered, fumed with disapproval whenever a squadron of Form 3 rockets was heard gargling and snorting at full volume just outside the staff room door. "That's what I can't understand about masters," Jennings confided to Derbyshire, as the two boys strato-cruised out of their classroom at the end of school one Monday afternoon. "They're always telling us we ought to do something useful in our spare time, but as soon as we take up a brainy hobby like advanced physics and stuff, they blow up like hydrogen bombs and tick us off for ragging in the corridors." "The trouble is, they don't seem to see things in the same way as ordinary civilised people like you and me," Derbyshire replied knowingly. "Not when they grow up, anyway. I dare say Mr. Wilkins was just as keen on all the latest crazes as we are when he was young." "Ah, but that was about 100 years ago," Jennings objected with wild exaggeration. "You can't expect us to get all worked up about magic lanterns and spinning wheels these days. It's time old Wilkie brought his ideas up to date. Why, I doubt if he'd even recognise a flying saucer if you brought him one on a plate with a sprig of parsley on the top." He exhaled loudly through his front teeth to apply his air brakes and made a skilful 3-point landing on the mat at the bottom of the stairs. Derbyshire landed beside him, muttering, "A junker, 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 junker," to show that he was throttling back his powerful engines, and for some moments they stood on their makeshift runway, shaking their heads sadly over the shortcomings of the staff. There was a comfortable, easy-going bond of friendship between the two boys, and much of it sprang from the fact that each was quite unlike the other, both in appearance and character. Jennings was the taller of the two, a friendly-looking boy of 11 with untidy brown hair and a wide-awake look in his eyes. He had about him the restless, eager air of one who acts first and thinks afterwards, of one who must be up and doing in all his waking moments, lest the grass should grow beneath his feet. Derbyshire, on the other hand, would not have worried unduly to find a whole prairie of grassland sprouting beneath his size 3 school sandals. But fortunately, his duties as Jennings' right-hand man gave no opportunity for such an alarming state of affairs to occur. For Derbyshire was quieter in manner, a loyal follower, but never a leader in the exploits and misadventures of school life. He was fair and curly, with a solemn, rather earnest look about his thin features. Behind his ink-splashed spectacles shone a pair of mild blue eyes which sparkled or clouded with every change in his feelings, as surely as a barometer recording the advent of sunshine or storm. Presently Jennings said,
"Well, let's not bother about old Wilkie any more. I had enough trouble racking my brains all through his English lesson to last me for some time."
Derbyshire looked surprised.
"What were you racking them about? I never heard him ask you any questions."
"Oh, no, it wasn't old Wilkie's fault," Jennings explained. "I was trying to make up my mind between 2 engine noises. Listen, Darby, which one sounds more like a spaceship landing on the moon? Vroom, 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 or doing, doing, doing?"
It was a question of some importance, and Derbyshire frowned thoughtfully as he tried out both noises with the full force of his lungs.
"I don't really know, Jen," he was forced to admit when the echoes had died away. "You see, my spaceship doesn't make that sort of noise at all. It just goes grinkle, grunkle, grunkle, ever so softly, because I've got a secret patent lever I've invented. It's a supersonic gadget. You just give it a flick and off you go. Mars, Venus, Mercury, any way you like."
He flung out his arm in a sweeping gesture to indicate the outermost limits of space. Then he added,
"And you needn't try to pretend that you've got one too, because it's my own special invention, copyright reserved."
Jennings was not impressed.
"I bet it's not so good as my supercharged atomic rockets," he said. "I'll challenge you to a race to prove it, if you like. The first one to get up the stairs and into the library, eh?"
"Righto," Derbyshire agreed.
"We could pretend the library is the moon, and you and I can be rival space pilots racing to be the first one ever to set foot on its surface. I like those chaps in that scientific comic of yours that Mr. Wilkins confiscated."
"Let's get our engines warmed up first, then," said Jennings.
"Voom, voom, voom, doing, 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 chigga, 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 grinkle, grunkle, grunkle," replied Derbyshire,
setting the mighty motors in action with a deft flick of an imaginary lever. The hall resounded to the roar of Jennings's rockets as the self-styled spaceships taxied to the starting point at the bottom of the stairs. But before they could become airborne, the door of the nearby staff room was flung open and Mr. Carter looked out to lodge a protest.
"If you must make that uncouth and horrible hullabaloo, I'd advise you to go as far away from the staff room as possible," he suggested reasonably. "How on earth do you expect me to add up marks with all the noise of a brass foundry going on just outside the door?"
"Sorry, sir, we were being spaceships," Jennings apologised. "It wasn't meant to sound like a brass foundry, sir. We were just setting off on a race to the moon."
"No doubt. But if interplanetary travel consists of grunting and snorting through your back teeth, I prefer something a little more old-fashioned," Mr. Carter observed.
Derbyshire felt called upon to put in a word for the march of progress.
"My father says rockets and spaceships are the coming thing, sir. Of course, nowadays we only pretend to zoom off to the moon and places, but one day, sir, who knows?"
"Who does indeed," replied Mr. Carter with a smile.
He was an agreeable, understanding sort of man in his early 30s. This meant that though still young when judged by grown-up standards, he had already achieved a ripe old age in the eyes of the boys whom he taught. He had been at Lynbury Court for some years, and had been teaching boys long enough to have learned a great deal about the way in which their minds worked. In this he was unlike his colleague Mr. Wilkins, who at that moment hove into sight at the top of the stairs. Mr. Wilkins, too, was fond of the boys in his charge, yet the more he saw of them, the more bewildered he became by the extraordinary things they chose to do. He was a loud-voiced, burly man with a brusque manner which concealed a heart of gold. Admittedly, the gold had worn thin in places, and few people were aware of its existence, but at odd and unexpected moments it would break through and dissolve his hasty temper like a watery sun dispelling the blustery March clouds. At the moment, however, there was no sign of the golden streak, and he clumped down the stairs with the ill humour of a bull in a cattle truck. As he reached the group in the hall, he heard Mr. Carter say, "All the same, Jennings, I would advise the Form 3 space pilots and the Dormitory 6 scientific researchers to carry out their work with rather less noise."
But the staff are growing somewhat jaded by so much interplanetary flight going on all over the building.